Good morning and welcome to All Things Political. I'm Anne Strainchamp, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn today, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Top story in the news, as it has been for 7 weeks now, is the oil spill off the Gulf Coast. The newest revised estimates are that more than 100 million gallons of oil have spilled so far. Of that, BP has managed to capture 5. President Obama is touring the Gulf Coast today. He plans an address from the Oval Office tomorrow. He'll reportedly have some announcements about aid packages for the states hit hardest by the spill and about BP's role in paying damage claims. President Obama, of course, is facing criticism of his handling of the disaster. And the oil spill isn't the only issue in the news we'll talk about. Also, the war in Afghanistan, now entering its 104th week, makes it the longest-running American war. And recent news about the discovery of huge untapped mineral reserves in Afghanistan is stunning. How might that alter the course of the war and the balance of political power in the Middle East? We have a couple of guests this hour to help us navigate some of these issues. Right now on the line with us is David Butler, director of the International Development Program at the University of Southern Mississippi. We'll be joined later this hour by Mark Schechsnyder, the regional coastal advisor for the Louisiana Sea Grant Program at Louisiana State University. He also chairs a response and recovery task force. So let's start with what's going on in the Gulf today. The president is headed there to make a fresh assessment. David, what do you think he's going to see?
Well, Ann, it depends on what he's looking at. I suspect he's going to probably receive an earful from a lot of locals that are upset about their economic livelihood being challenged over the past few weeks and the impact it's having on their local families.
Mm-hmm. How many different states is he going to, do you know?
He's going to be going to Mississippi, followed by Alabama, and then the Florida Panhandle today. All sites he hasn't visited yet. The last visits were all into southern Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. And now, is the oil hitting the Florida beaches yet?
Yes, it is. It's actually washed up both on Alabama beaches, the barrier islands outside of there, and also on Florida beaches. It has yet to hit the Mississippi beaches, thankfully, but all projections show everyone's going to be impacted to the east of Louisiana.
Yeah, and what about, I know we're already starting to see some of those devastating photos of oil-covered birds. There's a lot of concern about sea turtles. What's happening with the wildlife so far?
Wildlife, obviously, sea turtles are being impacted. A lot of the pelicans in Louisiana, where it's a breeding ground, is being influenced. And then there's always issues associated with the fisheries that are of main concern, both finfish that people traditionally think about, and then also oysters and other seafood items as well.
Mm. One of the hardest things about this disaster, I think, is that there's the immediate impact. We're just kind of reeling and responding to the images of the particular sea creatures, the fish, the birds that are being hurt, the beaches, the oil is damaging. But it's hard to get a handle on how widespread and how deep the economic impact is going to be. Can you try to flesh that out a bit?
Certainly. This morning, actually, we just released our first white paper in a 3-white paper series looking at the revenue shortfall just in Mississippi associated with the oil spill. And right now, our projections based upon the May numbers are between May 2010 to August 2010. We estimate from the tourism sector alone approximately $100 million shortfall.
Wow.
To put that in perspective, what that means is that non-casino hotels are down about 50%. Seafood restaurants are about down 30% from this time last year, and typical regular restaurants, non-seafood related, are down 15%. And so, that's where the $120 million comes from. This doesn't include the seafood sector, which is a little bit harder to track because you may have shrimpers that aren't fishing now or that aren't shrimping now because of closures in some of these areas, but some of them are working for BP, so we don't know exactly what those offset and net positive or loss are at this time.
But I remember hearing one of the NPR reports last week. They were doing an interview with a captain of a fishing boat on the Gulf who said, he's can't go out anymore. And he said he thought it's possible fishing is just done. I mean, over. He's not sure the fish will recover.
It is actually an unknown question. The one of the challenges that we face is the large number of dispersants used during this oil spill, especially at the low levels, have never been used before. So what it means to the ecosystem at various depths is unknown. So there is basically a big experiment going on.
Wait, so you mean it's not just a question of the oil damaging the fish populations, it's also the dispersants, the chemicals being used to attempt cleanup?
Exactly. It's both of them. And so all the biologists and marine scientists at the university that we've been in regular contact with say there's a big unknown, and whether the unknown is, you know, what's going to happen to the oil, what's going to happen to the dispersants. Is it going to get in the food chain, or is it going to be basically consumed by the oil-eating materials in there? And if it is consumed, then it actually may be a best practice that we're looking at that may come out in the future. If it's not, it could be one of the worst tragedies that may have a long-lasting impact. We just don't know at this time.
What a wonderful thing to be doing live experimentation. We've also got Mark Schechsnyder joining us. He's regional coastal advisor for the Louisiana Sea Grant Program at Louisiana State University. He also chairs a response and recovery task force there. And Mark, welcome to the program.
Hi, guys.
Hi. Anything you wanted to add? We're kind of trying to build up a picture of the sort of long-term economic and environmental damage from the oil spill.
I'm just joining us. I'm not really sure what you guys are talking about, but I did catch the last minute or so.
Yeah, well, you know, this issue of it's not just the oil that's pouring into the waters there, it's also the dispersants being used.
We have, like you guessed that, we have tons of unknowns that we're still working through. And so it is, you know, it's certainly an experiment in progress, and it is pretty, you know, nobody wants to be in this situation.
Yeah. How are the local economic effects likely to ripple out into the larger U.S. economy, do you think?
Well, it goes back to not knowing how much longer this is going to go on, how much oil is out there, both on the surface, below the surface, the fate of those oils. Roughly half or so of the productive area, maybe a little bit less, is closed to fishing, and has been for, you know, several weeks, some areas several months now. It's having tremendous localized economic impacts on places like Grand Isle, Hopedale, some of these coastal communities that really their lifeblood is fishing, either commercial fishing, recreational fishing, charter boat fishing. They're pretty much shut down. There's a lot of activity for cleanup, and they're putting people to work, some people to work doing that, but it's not the same, and it's not long-lasting. And then how long these areas are going to stay closed? You know, if we've been fairly—I hate to use the word fortunate—but we've been, you know, pretty fortunate, very fortunate so far with the amount of oil that hasn't come into the wetlands. We have some oiled areas. It did not. You know, most areas are not highly oiled. Some areas are just closed for precaution. And then the wind could shift, and it comes in waves. One day it looks really bad, one day it looks good. Most days, the last time I went to Grand Isle last week, it was very little oil in the water at all. They were just getting off what was on the shoreline and on the beach.
Mm. And then let me sort of give a Mississippi perspective here. I know less about the local economy in South Louisiana, but 5 to 6% of Mississippi is based on tourism. And really, in terms of seafood production, you're looking at about 0.6% of GDP. So it's not a huge number, but the reality is if you are the charter boat fisherman, or if you're the person who's selling tackle or ice to people that can't go out on their boats, or if you are a shrimper that doesn't have other livelihood and you still have payments on your boat, even if you are a small percent of the gross domestic product, it doesn't change the fact that, you know, you're looking at dire economic circumstances in front of you.
Mm-hmm. And is this the kind of thing, I mean, I guess one of the difficult parts is that we don't know how long this is likely to go on. So, you know, a fisherman, for instance, who's thinking, okay, so is it this season that I'm out of work? Will I be okay, you know, a year from now? Is everything going to be picked back up? Will the tourists be back next winter? Or are we talking about losing next winter's tourist season too?
Right, that's a very, very important problem, and one that they're facing each day. So if they are in a revenue shortfall, they have to ask, do I want to go borrow money for the future, when in fact I don't know if I can pay off that line of credit in the future because next season may not. Is there a brand image with the Gulf of Mexico seafood that's been hurt long-term, or is it just a short-term the oil comes on shore? it gets cleaned up and everyone's back to their normal routine. And these are the sort of the unknowns from the economic side. They're going to play out from the unknowns on the biology side in the water.
You know, and as we're seeing more and more, as we've seen throughout the last several years of economic recession and depression, you know, nothing that happens in the economy happens in isolation anymore. You know, it is not possible for there to be a devastating blow like this to a local or regional economy that isn't going to trickle through the rest of the nation's economy, is there?
Economically, I don't think so. For instance, you can look at oyster prices. Right now, you know, oysters should be they're being harvested from the Gulf typically. Well, now they're starting to pull oysters from the Pacific Northwest and from the northeast part of the United States. Well, those prices are obviously going to go up since there's a lower supply. And if people in the south want to eat oysters, those are going to have to be shipped over land or flown, so the prices are going to drive up. So there are effects throughout the nation's economy on the supply and demand from those pieces. Likewise, if tourists have chosen to either delay or not go to vacation along the Gulf of Mexico, they're probably going to go on holiday somewhere. That's going to, you know, there's going to be some winners out there that from that shifting dollars being spent on tourism.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm just thinking of all our listeners in Wisconsin. You know, for the Gulf Coast is a big place a lot of us in Wisconsin head to in order to get through winter. You know, I know so many people who spend a week or up to 6 weeks somewhere on the Florida coast every winter. You know, what are the beaches going to be like this coming winter? You know, are we all going to want to cancel our trips?
And the real question is the oil spill needs to be capped. And there's no known way to cap an oil spill except by an additional well being drilled into it. That's the time-proven method. And they've said repeatedly it takes 90 days to do that. It's only when the oil stops flowing will we have a good indication from that starting point on when the effects will be declining or what they will be. But until then, as more gallons pour out, you know, we don't know what the multiplier is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are doing something today to capture an additional, hopefully, 5 to 10,000 barrels per day. And they're moving to some more. Just it's a stopgap measure, though. Guess is right. You absolutely have to cap the thing and get it stopped. But they are moving to collect more oil before it gets to the surface or gets into the water column, which it's you know, a little positive.
I guess to those of us who are, you know, just reading the headlines, there's a little bit of a feeling of disbelief. Like, yes, I understand that the oil well is a mile below the surface of the water, so it must be an incredibly difficult proposition to try to figure out how to do something about it. And on the other hand, it's been 7 weeks. You know, we can send people to the moon. Why can't we deal with one gushing oil well?
Well, I've been talking to a lot of deep sea geologists and engineers, and it's I think what they're estimating is around 14,000 pounds of pressure. You got a system that was compromised from the well being pulled around by the riser. So you've got some really, you know, it's an incredibly difficult area to work in, and the tools to get down there is just, and I'm not an engineer, I'm a marine biologist, mm-hmm. but it's just, you know, watching the thing and watching the efforts and talking to people, it's an extremely, extremely complicated situation. And there is also the possibility of them losing what they have down there, which nobody wants to think about, but it's in the realm of possibilities.
What do you mean, losing what they have down there?
From what I understand, if the blowout preventer would blow off of it, you would have much more flow coming out than you do. In fact, the estimates that they just came back, they're getting, you know, close to what we've been thinking all along as far as the amount of oil coming out, and guesstimating at 40,000 barrels per day. That was before they cut the riser off. But if you lose all of the blow-off preventer and everything that is creating friction in the pipes and then some of these other pipes that come out, you can actually increase the flow.
Increase to how much, do you think?
I've never heard that number, but it's more than it is now. And again,
How likely is that to happen, do you think?
We don't get answers like that, and I'm not sure anybody has an answer to give us, you know, as far as what the possibilities of each scenario are. I'm hoping that it's very light, and as they pull more oil off of it, it's, you know, and their well just keeps going as it's going, and they were overestimating the time that it gets to get it closed off. But the, again, they don't. You know, this, that, this, I don't think those numbers actually exist. Mm-hmm. Give you a percentage.
I want to open up.
But you want to be realistic about everything, and you know.
Mm-hmm. I want to open this up to our listeners. I know we've got callers with questions and comments on this subject. They've been, a lot of our listeners have been following this from the very beginning. We're talking with Mark Schecksnyder. He's regional coastal advisor for the Louisiana Sea Grant Program at Louisiana State University, where he also chairs a response and recovery task force. And David Butler is director of the International Development Program at the University of Southern Mississippi. We'll be taking your calls as well. The number is 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Is there an issue in the news that you would like to understand better? Do you have questions about this oil spill, the government's or BP's response? What would you like the president to say tomorrow night when he addresses the nation on the subject of the oil spill? 800-642-1234. I'm Ann Strangchamps, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the oil spill in the Gulf this morning. Our guests are David Butler from the International Development Program at the University of Southern Mississippi and Mark Schecksnyder, Regional Coastal Advisor for the Louisiana Sea Grant Program. And we've got callers with questions and comments. Let's go first to Mary in Janesville. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thank you very much for having this wonderful program. And thank you both to both of your guests for appearing on your program. I have one question that has bothered me since the very beginning, and I know it may be a teeny-weeny bit off topic, but I think it's very pertinent. Why is it that BP is being left to do this alone? I understand their company. I understand it's their responsibility. But this has far-reaching implications that have nothing to do with ownership. This is about the sea, which belongs to all of us, and about the animals, and about the environment, and about many other things, long-term effects. Why haven't people stepped up from all over the world to help us with this?
Good question. Gentlemen?
Mark, I'll let you take that one.
There's going to be a lot of questions that there are no answers for. I think you're seeing, I'm seeing from down here, and I guess you guys are seeing the same thing. Is I think they were caught way off guard with the amount of oil that was coming out, and I don't have any answers to that. I don't think anybody does. But when you don't realize it's the scale of a problem, it's hard to scale your response to it. And I think what we've seen is now that they're actually understanding how much it is, you're seeing the federal government, the federal agencies, and the state and local guys have been very proactive and very adamant about taking control of the situation and not letting BP run the show, because their information is not always stands up to the test of time.
Hmm. But is this the kind of situation that more resources would have helped with? I mean, just with containing, you know, the spill. You know, let's say.
Well, I mean, it's.
Well, I was going to say, you know, let's say the U.S. government, you know, said, this is such a disaster, we're going to do a Manhattan Project-style thing. We're going to throw, you know, university and corporate resources at this. We're going to put our best, you know, world-class engineers, gather them from around the world, and throw them at this. Would it have made a difference?
I'm not sure that it wasn't happening. I mean, we don't know what was going on in the closed-door meetings. I know there's been tons and tons of people from the whole industry, from federal, state, local. There's been so many people looking at it from different angles. But, you know, as far as the response goes to the oil spill in Alaska, once they had their spill 20 years ago, they have a set, all the commercial fishermen that want to be involved in it are trained. They have collection material on hand. They get paid a stipend to be on call 24/7. They have crews. And when there is a spill, they have a ready-made response with the fishing vessels. We don't have that in the Gulf. We're hoping to get that now, but, of course, now it's too late. The whole fact that it was that they were allowed to take that risk, the company was you know, throwing that much risk on us for their profit, is, you know, something that's certainly going to be talked about for a long time.
Hmm. Yeah, David, anything to add?
Well, BP, as well as a lot of the other oil companies, probably single-handedly have more knowledge and deep sea drilling than anybody else, including the federal government. And so you think of their North Sea drilling and other drilling around the world. So they probably have within their company the best knowledge base and probably access to the best technologies. But I think I agree with Mark that, you know, there was, I mean, this was a surprise. This wasn't expected. And these are sort of new emerging areas going deep water into the Gulf of Mexico. And so I think, though it seems on a 24-hour news cycle that things are moving unbearably slow, I think in some sense, you know, having multiple ships out there, ships on the way, remotely operated vehicles down there capturing live feed, things are probably moving a little bit faster than probably if the feds were in charge of it, trying to move up the bureaucracy to try to capture it or to turn something around.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We've got another caller on the line, Daniel in Milwaukee. Good morning.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. A question with everyone being surprised at the magnitude of this problem. I'm guessing oil rigs were never kind of protected by Homeland Security or like a drill in case a terrorist attack were going forward. Would that be something the government's willing to look into?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, do you think there are terrorists out there who are now thinking, gee, an oil rig looks like a terrific target?
I'm absolutely sure that the federal government, through Homeland Security, through the Coast Guard, et cetera, knows that oil rigs are potential targets, as well as many other sites, and I'm sure those are on the list to be examined.
And let's try Ken in Milton. Hi, Ken. Hello, Ken. Hi, sorry, I think we missed you. Can you start again?
Yes, how many wells are there pumping oil in the Gulf, and why do spills have such a low priority? I mean, you said that they didn't have the fishermen involved to deal with the spills, but they've been pumping oil out of the Gulf for a long time, I mean, 40, 50 years. And, you know, why do spills have such a low priority?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As far as technology or whatever.
Mark, David?
Mark, do you want to tackle this one?
Mark, are you still there? Nope, guess we lost Mark. David,
do you? Sorry. I don't know. The question is, if you're asking if it's low priority to what? I think there are. I mean, it's national news. The Obama administration has said he's, you know, has all of his secretaries and their agencies working on it. BP has admitted, you know, that they're responsible and are taking responsible action. I'm trying to think of what other resources could have been thrown at this. And also, yes, the Gulf of Mexico, they have been pulling oil out of the Gulf for a long time, but most of that has been in shallower waters. This is a deep water rig. It is sort of into new territory within the Gulf of Mexico, areas that have not been reachable both technologically as well as economically affordable until very recent. So we are in sort of some new territory right now.
But I thought you said just a minute ago, or one of you said that when the spills happened, you know, up in Alaska, those companies had kind of emergency response and preparedness packages kind of ready to go in a way that there was not in the Gulf.
Yeah, that Mark mentioned that, and that's new information to me. But the logic behind it, as sort of a ready reserve in place, makes sense. And I agree with Mark, more than likely that's going to be the new status quo beyond this bill.
Yeah, and they didn't have it for the Valdez. They instituted that afterwards.
Oh, after the boy,
yep.
It's a shame it always happens after a disaster.
We're really getting good at lessons learned.
So, what difference would it have made if there had been? I mean, can you paint a picture of what that, you know, ready response team would look like if we had been adequately prepared? What would have been there?
What we're not seeing, and what we kind of, you know, everybody's been pushing for, is to get more skimmers, more boats that can actually go actively collect oil from the surface of the water before it impacts the shorelines. We just, you know, they're gathering people's names, they're training them, they're getting equipment as the spill's going on, instead of that being in place where you might have had 1,000 boats or 2,000 boats to throw at the situation. And if you catch it, you capture it offshore, you know, you don't have to deal with it as it comes inshore on the beaches or in the wetlands. That's one thing. I mean, you have to go look through the whole, you know, whether there were disbursements, whether there were booms, stockpiled in place. It's been just a tremendous catch-up game the last 6-7 weeks.
It's interesting. You described lots and lots of boats out there. The image that flashed on my mind was Dunkirk, you know, from World War II. And
we got the guys that were they're doing everything they can. But yeah, had they been ready, it could have been almost a
Dunkirk kind of thing. Like everybody with a boat, get out there, and here's a skimmer, and get out and do your part.
Mm-hmm.
Well, something for the future, I guess. What do you think about the whole issue of BP's culpability in all of this? You know, that's people have gone back and forth, and BP has said one thing and then another. They've certainly come in for plenty of criticism. The president seems to be getting ready to come down pretty heavy in terms of insisting on a reserve set aside for damages. How culpable is BP in all of this?
You can have that one, Dave.
Thanks for handing that. BP, I think from the very beginning, and to be honest, as a surprise to me, has come out and taken full responsibility of this. They don't own 100% of the rig. They, you know, shares of oil rigs are shared and risk is spread. Transocean hasn't come out and taken responsibility. Halliburton, as a contractor, hasn't. So BP, in some sense, has come out to the forefront and said, you know, we're the responsible party and we'll do what we can to clean it up. And from a corporate perspective, I was very surprised to hear that. I'm sure, considering their stock is down significantly, not all shareholders are happy with that decision, but that's one that they've made. I know that is quite different than the approach that Exxon took after the Valdez spill.
And what about the suggestions that BP for years had been cutting corners and that this was in some ways an accident waiting to happen?
I don't have any internal knowledge of that. I mean, I've read that as much as anyone else has, but I think that's much more investigation yet to be found to determine if that is the case and whether that was standard practice or just someone that's upset trying to get some message out there right now.
Mm. You know, it's hard to imagine any company surviving in the face of a disaster this overwhelming. Is BP going to survive this?
The answer is it depends on what the Obama administration and BP choose to do. Right now, there's talk, I believe today the board is meeting in London to determine whether or not they're going to suspend or cut the dividend, which is over $2 billion to shareholders, and put that into some sort of recovery account. If they decide to do that, obviously the shareholders are going to be somewhat upset, and not surprisingly. Additionally, you know, BP has admitted, you know, culpability here. They say they'll pay for the full cleanup effort. If you sort of milk the company dry, if you kill the golden goose, in a sense, you no longer have resources to go after. Therefore, it's then going to fall onto the shoulders of the American taxpayer to handle the cleanup. So in a sense, there is a balance here. If BP is willing to pay for the cleanup, then you can't milk the company dry. You can harvest the golden egg, but you don't want to kill the goose.
Hmm. Or do you? I don't know. I was just looking at... I think the Daily Beast the other day noticed Alec Baldwin had a column, you know, we should let BP go under. I mean, would it be so bad if BP did? Maybe an oil company should have to face the full cost of what it's done.
Well, I mean, that is clearly one perspective, but is the presumption that no one's going to come and fill that void? I mean, we drive our vehicles. There's a huge need for petroleum-based products all throughout the world, and I don't think if BP were to be forced into some sort of bankruptcy that another oil company would not fill its vacuum. I'm almost positive that it would until alternative sources of energy are found.
Yeah, and that's sort of the other issue, isn't it? You know, to a certain extent, we're all culpable. I mean, we're part of this oil-guzzling economy. You know, it's our need, our demand that drives companies like BP to continue to... Anyway, so I'm just wondering, I haven't seen the discussion moving that way, but you could imagine that as a result of a disaster like this, there'd be a huge widespread public call for, you know, a stepped-up move to abandon our dependence on oil.
The price of gas, if I understand from the Lundberg survey this morning, is $2.73. The last time I heard a national call for alternative fuel, I think the average gallon was about $4. So there is clearly a price sensitivity to the average consumer on whether or not they're willing to give up their fossil fuel oil-based vehicles, and part of that's price sensitivity at the pump.
What do you think the – do you have a dollar figure in mind for the point at which how expensive does gas at the pump have to be before people make really serious changes in their lifestyles?
I don't – I mean, I have not explored this in detail, but in my lifetime – I'm 40 years old. In my lifetime, that's only happened twice, once during the OPEC oil shortage when I was younger, and then second of all, when we had the high prices a few years ago. Those are the only two points I've seen where people making radical economic shifts and decisions to go to hybrid vehicles, to go to bicycles, to look for smaller vehicles. Other than that, everyone, the average American seems to be going with the standard flow of consumer purchase they've always done.
Hmm. We've got some more callers on the line. Let's go to Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I'm sure that the two parties, the two deregulatory parties, the Republicans and the corporate DLC, Obama-Clinton wing of the Democratic Party, will try to blame each other. But, if you go back to the old days of what George Wallace said back in the day, that there's not a dime's worth of difference between the two of them, because in terms of what they say and what they do, they may be different, but what they do is support deregulation, which got us into the mess in the first place. And the thing that's really sad about it is that it appears increasingly that we're not going to be having a chance to get any other type of alternative thinking established. And a good example of that was what happened in the primary elections this last week in Arkansas. You can very quickly Google Arkansas election fraud, and you'll find out something about electronic voting, and you'll also find out about how there was a county where the opponent of Blanche Lincoln, the right-of-center Democrat, had done very well in the previous, before the runoff, and they had 40 precincts cut down to two precincts in a county of 76,000 registered voters. And this is just basically a continuation of what the Republicans did in Florida and Ohio, where they suppressed the vote, and you can read that in Greg Palast's books. So, the key issue here is, is there any difference between the two parties, and what are we going to be able to do to protect our rights to establish a difference in the legislative branch?
Mm-hmm. David, any thoughts there?
So the question is whether or not whether it's the Republican or Democrats or whatever wing of each of those parties is in power, whether or not there'll be more regulation or less regulation, is what I gather.
I think that was the gist of it.
Okay. I think there's going to be a response to this. I mean, this has made national news. It's had economic impact. There's ecological impact. I mean, there is going to be some sort of oversight, I believe, no matter who's in power, whichever party's in power, that's going to come down more than likely from the executive branch. Maybe from the legislative branch as well, because the idea is, as Mark said, we're learning a lot after the fact. Well, those lessons will be implemented.
Mm. We've also got Fred on the line from Watersmead in Michigan. Hi, Fred.
Hi, guys. I have several questions.
Mm-hmm.
First, the elementary one, which I can't figure out, is why aren't the booms higher? It seems like they're the height of them, and especially in the ocean, the oil goes right over them. So why don't they have booms that are higher?
Hold on, let's take them one in a row. Mark, do you have a response to that?
This all types of booms. The sore booms are the ones that actually catch the oil. I think what you're talking about is the ocean-going booms. And the problem with booms is that that a lot of them aren't properly being used. The booms deflect oil, and you deflect oil to be able to catch it. If you're just deflecting it to push it someplace else, then you're really not solving the problem. Now, another problem with booms is they just don't work in high seas. The oil goes under them, over them, through them, and if you had them even taller, it still wouldn't solve the problem of oil getting pushed and then just pushed directly under the boom. That's a big problem we have in the passes right now with a high velocity of water. A boom is just totally ineffective in those situations. You have to get to a lower energy area.
Mm-hmm. And Fred, did you have another quick question?
But if they use properly, they can be used to gather oil, and they are being used.
Mm-hmm. Fred, did you have another quick question?
Oh, sure. I guess I'm kind of upset when Obama goes down there to look at it, and it looked like it was a dog and pony show orchestrated by BP, where he doesn't even get to see the areas hardest hit. And from what I understand, the Coast Guard actually, it was BP's orders, keeps reporters or anybody away from the areas that are hardest hit. So I would like to see Obama go down there and have McCarville taking him out to the areas that have been hit rather than just, it seems like, being led by the hand by BP.
I'm sure James Carville would love to do that, too. But you know, I'm not defending anybody because we're not taking sides. But the last, when Obama did come last week, he was on Grand Isle, which was the one of the sites of the heaviest impact. And he was able, so I was out there last week, and there's still oil that washes up on the beach every day. Like I said, the day I went, it wasn't that bad. But he has been to some of the harder hit areas. I think everyone would like to see more of it, you know.
We're talking with Mark Schechsnyder. He's the regional coastal advisor for the Louisiana Sea Grant Program at Louisiana State University, where he also chairs a response and recovery task force. Also, we're talking with David Butler. He is director of the International Development Program at the University of Southern Mississippi. We're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. If you've got questions about the oil spill, the U.S. government, or BP's response. Also, what would you like to hear the president say tomorrow night when he addresses the nation about the oil spill? 800-642-1234. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the Gulf Coast oil spill. Let's go next to David in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, David.
Well, good morning, and I appreciate this opportunity. I gave your screener one comment. I have just one quick one previous to that. And that had to do with the discussion about the price of oil is now $2.72. All of us can remember in 1973 when President Carter tried to do something about this, and it went by the boards. And just a quick comment if we were including the price in our gas of our military adventures in the Mideast, it would be more like $6 or $7 a gallon. But we're not really calculating the full price of our oil because of that particular reason. But my original comment was that there's a lot of weeping and gnashing of teeth, and there certainly is plenty of blame to go around, and I'm sure that the Obama administration could have done some things differently. But just presume now that we go back to a month before this spill began, and the administration had been clamping down on the oil companies because they thought that they weren't prepared for such an eventuality, and forced them to start doing some planning for cleaning up a possible spill. First, you would have heard from Dick Cheney, who was involved in setting up our energy planning in a secret meeting with oil companies. And secondly, all of these politicians in the Gulf states who are taking advantage of the oil revenues coming in the workers, and it's something like 40% to 50% of their economy is involved in this oil. They would have been screaming to high heaven that the oil companies were being harassed by the administration. And these are also the same people that say, get the government out of our business. The government can't do anything right. And now I just heard one of the senators from the Gulf states this morning upset because the government isn't, quote, doing something. And this just really frosts my rear end, I got to tell you.
Thanks. David, any comments?
One of the challenges, let me sort of put this in historical context, economically at least. South Mississippi, there's three counties along the Mississippi Gulf Coast. Hurricane Katrina hit on August 29th, 2005. Those counties never fully recovered economically up until December 2007 when the recession hit. When the recession hit, obviously, they were down. It looked like they were recovering pretty fair in the first four months, of 2010, and now the oil spill. So it has been sort of a 1-2-3 punch disaster, be it economic or natural disasters happening to this area. After Katrina, obviously, there were some problems with the response, but there were some federal aid flowing in, so that helped rebuild the economy. I think what people are looking for is you have this disaster unfolding and you were in an economic recovery period. Where is the stimulus going to come from that's going to help keep it along a good trajectory for recovery it's not going to help it, you know, it's not going to enable it to slow down. So I think people are looking for an economic stimulus, and most people, whether they like it or not, the government's usually the one that provides it in a time of natural disaster.
Mm. But the caller's point was, you know, partly that, you know, there's a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of situation that a president is in right now. You know, you, on the one hand, don't want to step all over the oil companies and take over the disaster response. And on the other hand, you know, if he's on the other hand, he's being accused of pussyfooting around the oil companies and not doing enough.
No, I mean that's clearly the political problem that he faces right now. I mean, he's the president has stepped up and said he's responsible. But if you get too far into it, whatever failures occur become your failures. Right now, there is somewhat of an arm length distance that allows, you know, to point the blame at the company. And so, yeah, that is a very delicate political balance that the administration has to walk.
I have the impression that the administration was very careful from the beginning, possibly not to get too involved because they didn't, you know, we already have a damaged economy. I think they were wanting to make sure BP would foot the full cost. You know, they didn't want to say, okay, we'll jump in and help clean up and help pay for everything. And, you know, they'd rather have BP be fully culpable.
No, I agree with that. There is clearly is who's going to pay, and there's already been enough hit from the stimulus packages, from the health care bill, of the cost issue, and now to turn around and say the federal government's going to cover this, the American taxpayer is going to cover this, may be politically untenable. So having BP come to the table and say they're going to cover it is probably the most politically viable solution right now.
I wonder if there's also some issue about legal liability. If the U.S. government had gotten very involved in the cleanup from the beginning, would BP have been able to say, hey, you know, we're not completely liable for this. You know, you made mistakes during the cleanup, and some of this isn't our fault.
I think there, I understand the logic, and I've thought through those as well, but not being an attorney, I'd hate to speculate in that direction.
Right. Oh, let's check with a couple of other callers. Paul's been waiting patiently from Washington County. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning. I might suggest to the listeners to go to www.oceantech.us, log in and study that for a bit, and then call your senator and have these inept senators do some get out of cattle prod. Number two, I have a very good friend and business associate, and he's already moving on a patent with a large law firm with a patent protection. And he's going to come up with a method and system for the injection of liquid nitrogen into the well shaft, 320 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, which will solidify that oil and create its own plug to get the non-shrink hydraulic cementitious material in there for the fix. You know what? He can't talk to a human being at the U.S. Coast Guard. That's in a position of authority. He can't talk to a BP, period. They're guarding his wellhead as if it was the crown jewels of England. And so there you are. It's a totally out-of-the-box method. And he's got Air Liquide out of France.
Sorry, I just want to interject there. I imagine there are all kinds of everybody's reaching for possible experimental things that might help, but I think from what you said earlier, Mark, is to the point. You're talking about a situation where there's 14,000 pounds of pressure and some concern that if you mess about too much, the disaster could get much worse.
Correct. Yeah. And there's a lot of people running around and with solutions, and there's a scientific panel that's put together to assess those and independent ideas. They're actively trying to, you know, I think they're open to suggestions. I think clearly they are. It's just a very, very, it's quite a mess.
Whatever happened with, I never really followed, remember somebody was calling Kevin Costner. There are all these jokes circulating online about, let's just call Kevin Costner. Whatever happened with Kevin Costner's solution?
The Gulf is huge. It's the spill is vast, far-reaching. Those machines, I just, you know, like I tell most of the guys, when we have a next time we have an oil spill in a bowl, we'll give you a call. It's just such a, he's got a good device. It's one tool. There's no silver bullets. That bullet would have been fired a long time ago had one of those solutions been viable. Right? And I'm not saying there aren't others that aren't being looked at, and you know, people need to try and push those ideas into the system. But you know, we're not going to throw hay and make this thing go away. Mm-hmm. But that is one tool. I think going back to the point about the regulation, all that there's a lot of people that do business in the Gulf of Mexico, and they do it responsibly. And some of the pushback you're hearing from down here is that we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. We do use oil and gas. We have a lot of companies that do it safely. We haven't had many accidents, and hopefully this will be the last big one. But you never know. You have to get more prepared. You got to have more regulations to prevent that. I don't think they ever should have been able to take the risk they took. The engineers I talked to said that in a situation like that, you have at least triple redundancy on every protection system you have, and that clearly wasn't the case here.
Mm. So we've got an email from Janet who has a good question. She says, from what I've heard and read, the ultimate fix is to drill another well. Mark, I think you referred to that.
They're drilling two wells right now. They should be drilling more, in my low opinion, but...
She says, I don't understand how this will stop oil flowing from the current well. Could you explain that?
They're drilling a well, and they're going to intercept that pipe and drill into that pipe and then inject cement down at the very bottom in a way that, because it's porous rock and there's oil that comes through it. So what they're going to do is just keep injecting a lot of the drilling mud, kind of like they did with the top kill, but all the way from the bottom. And that's a proven method of closing the well. So they're going to actually drill into it. The technology is just, you know, it's space age stuff. Beyond that, it's they're going to, you know, 3 miles down below another mile of water, they're going to hit that pipe with another pipe, drill through this really hardened steel casing, and then when they get that done, that's what's taking so long. When they get there, then they're going to inject cement.
Wow, that doesn't scare you? I just think maybe we'll wind up with, you know, two gushing oil wells then.
No, they're putting, you know. They're putting blowout preventers and stuff on top of that one. And then we drill all the time. This is, you know, it's unfortunate it happened. It's like David was saying, this is new territory. We need to refine and get our technology down, or you shouldn't be out there, you know, drilling if you can't safely do it. Mm-hmm. So you better believe that whoever's drilling these side wells are being overlooked in the nth degree with every safety precaution they can. And you know, everything that we do is risk. It has a risk to it, and it all involves trade-offs. Yeah. I mean, if we had windmills that would just produce all the energy, then you'd have a lot of bird impact. So, I mean, it's just, I'm not trying to, you know, I'm looking for the first non-gas car myself, but I'm in foundation.
Yeah.
But I'll be in line to buy it.
How many square miles is this bill covering now?
Oh, it's, you know, if you look at the images, if people want to look at some of the updates, they have if you do a search for Gulf Grant Oil, we have a web page that has all the different, all the latest things. It's several hundred, maybe I think now several thousand square miles. But when you say that, it's, you know, most of those areas are sheen or ribbons, and it's not, you know, it's not foot thick oil every place. It's very misleading when you see a map that's just covers a third of the Gulf, and you assume that that's all oil. There's a lot of oil out there, but it's not as broad. And as, you have to look at the other diagrams where you see light, medium, sheen to get a better image.
Do you guys have thoughts about what you would like to hear the president say tomorrow night to the nation, David?
What would I like for him to say? To be honest, I don't know what more he can say. I'm sure he's going to try to sound reassuring and give leadership. But to be honest, I think the executive branch has used all the tools at its disposal to date. The bureaucracy is, it takes a while to wind up. It's winding up to do what it does. But there's not, if there was a way to stop it, it would have been stopped by now. It's just going to take time to get it under control. And I think, if anything, he's just going to say, you know, reassure everyone that he's executive in charge, and he's going to ensure that everyone is treated fairly in process.
Hmm. I'd like him to say that we have it stopped. But
I would love to hear that as well.
Yeah, I met with three cabinet level people just last week alone, and I'm not sure if there's anything else they could do. We all want to see it done as fast as possible.
Well, that's kind of good news to hear that even the guys who are down there feel like the federal government's doing what they can. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you, Ann.
Thank you very much, Ann.
All right. David Butler is professor of economic geography and director of the International Development Program at the University of Southern Mississippi. Mark Schechsnyder, regional coastal advisor, Agricultural Center and Louisiana Sea Grant College Program at Louisiana State University. Don't go away. We've got more coming up in just a couple of minutes. We will be talking about impact of children on children of growing up in homes without fathers. You are listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for this hour to Rhonda Fanning and to all the other assistants who help make these programs possible. Thanks to all of you who called, and stay with us.